Welcome to Signs of Life, exploring survival of consciousness. Brought to you by Forever Family Foundation, on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
I call your name, the echo is haunting, the echo is always the same. I call your name, the echo is haunting, an echo can never be changed, so I call your name.
And welcome to Signs of Life Radio. I'm Bob Ginsberg, and we have a good show for you tonight. Ricky Stern will be joining us soon, and we have Leslie Kane. Before I introduce our guests, we're going to do this show without any commercial breaks tonight. We have a lot to talk about. I just wanted to mention, before we get going, the Foundation Valentine's Day raffle is active, and you can enter via our website and win one of four readings with two certified mediums of the Foundation, Gina Simone and Joe Peretta. If you haven't seen it yet, and we're going to be talking about it tonight, Surviving Death, the docuseries on Netflix, is currently streaming, so you don't want to miss that. Medium Explosion, which is my new book, is available on Amazon in a book form or Kindle. There's a link on our website. Of course, all the profit will go to Forever Family Foundation. It's an exploration into the world of mediums. So appreciate it if you took a look at that. And maybe tonight, or certainly within the next day or two, we're going to be launching our new website. We've been working on it a long time. Fran started it about 18 months ago, and it's finally coming to fruition. So could launch tonight, or you know, maybe in a day or two. So take a look at that. Now, Leslie Kane, some of our audience may be familiar with Leslie. She's worked with us before, and we respect her work. She's an independent investigative journalist, and she's focused on bringing credible information about the hidden and the paranormal and the impossible realities. She likes to bring those into the mainstream. She's the author of Surviving Death, a journalist investigates evidence of an afterlife. And her prior book, which was a bestseller, UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record. Now, as I mentioned, the docuseries on Netflix is based upon Leslie's Surviving Death book. And Leslie is the consulting producer of the series. You can learn more about Leslie and her books by her website, survivingdeathkane.com. And Kane is K-E-A-N. And welcome to the show, Leslie.
Hi, Bob. So great to be back with you. Yeah, great to hear your voice again.
Same here. And Ricky's not with us yet, I imagine, but hopefully she'll be calling in soon. So
I hope so.
Yeah, but I mean, before we get started, I should ask you, I mean, how are things going with this series? I mean, how has it been received so far? I mean, are you getting a lot of feedback and interest?
Yeah, I mean, and again, you can ask, Ricky probably knows more than I do about the actual, you know, numbers and all of that. But as far as I can tell, it's doing well. I mean, the first week, 10 days, it was in the top 10 in the U.S. on Netflix, and it was down to number four, you know, as high as number four for a while. So that's pretty impressive for a show to get that kind of rating so quickly. I've been getting a zillion messages and emails and private Facebook messages from people who love it, but a lot of it is too people that are telling me their own stories. You know, a lot of people don't talk about these things very much. And I think one of the wonderful things about the series is it's giving people permission to recognize the value of their own experiences. And people are sharing the stories with me. They've done this with UFOs, and now they're doing it with this topic. So anything we can do to get people encouraged to take value in their experiences and to feel that they're okay to talk about them, there's nothing wrong with them, there's nothing abnormal or weird about them, to me, that alone is enough to make the whole thing worth it, just that.
Yeah, you're right, and one of the goals of the series is to open minds. You know, I mean, there are a lot of people watching that are just curious. You know, and I would imagine that you have a lot of people contacting you because you know after seeing you on in the various episodes, they know that you're somebody that's going to be interested in what they have to say, and you're not going to judge them. So you're safe.
And I am interested.
Yeah,
I'm just having trouble finding time to respond to all of them. And I hope anybody who's written me, who's listening, doesn't take any lack of response personally, because I will respond to everybody. There's just been so many that I haven't had the time. But yeah, you're right. I mean, I think the point of the series is really not just, we're not trying to prove anything or convince anybody of anything. It's really, as you say, about opening people's minds and allowing them to kind of take from this whatever they want. And just, I hope that it just opens people to the possibility of this other reality and makes them curious and gives them a sense that, you know, maybe there is something else. But it's very much about just asking questions and showing people on journeys dealing with these issues, just like we did with you and Fran. You know, it wasn't just about your work with Forever Family, but it was also about your own personal journeys. So, you know, that's a lot of what the focus of the series is about, is just showing people, regular people, going through these various experiences.
Yeah, and I think you succeeded in that. So, you know, as an investigative journalist, how do you embark on the projects, you know, that you wind up, you know, delving into? Is it in part a search for your own answers? I mean, it seems that, you know, I know that your two, you know, big books, The Surviving Death and the UFO book, I mean, you had an interest in the subject before you started writing about it. Did you not?
I did, Bob. I've had an interest in this for years, you know, and I was particularly drawn into it through the cases of young children with past life memories. I just had studied that and found them so interesting and so convincing. But you know, embarking on this book, the journey of writing this book was a learning process as well. I mean, it's not like I had all this stuff figured out when I sat down to write it. And not only was it a learning experience in terms of the research I did, but also in terms of the experiences that I had myself. And in that sense, it was really different than the UFO book, because with that book, it was kind of a culmination of 10 years of work, and I just sort of had all the information there, and I got the chapters that I needed from the individuals who contributed and did the book. But this was like a whole journey. I didn't know how it was going to come out, and it certainly didn't come out all in every way that I expected. So, yeah, it really was about learning as I went along. And it was because I was curious. It was because I wanted to learn more about it.
Yeah,
I wanted to write it. Yeah,
yeah. In the UFO book, I mean, you did a tremendous amount of research, but it wasn't as if you had personal encounters, you know, with UFOs. Whereas with Surviving Death, you participated. I mean, you had some incredible, you know, readings with mediums. You experienced physical mediumship. It was a personal journey for you, you know, unlike the other book.
Right.
So I totally understand what you're saying.
Yeah, it was very different in that way. And also having lost my brother and experiencing the whole after-death communication thing. So, you know, that and mediumship were the two things that I really did come up against personally. And it was a big part of the book for me to do that. Yeah.
If you were to guess, there's no way of really knowing unless you examine the data, but why do you think that most people tune into watching, you know, the Surviving Death, you know, series? I mean, is it curiosity? Is it their fear of dying? Is it their grief or questioning their own mortality? Or what do you think? It's a combination of all those things.
Probably a combination, Bob. I can't say that I really know. I mean, I think probably there's so many different reasons why people would tune in. I think a lot of people that have written to me, of course, are people that have an interest in it, and that's why they tuned in, and it really means something to them, you know, because they've had their own experiences. But I wish I could answer that question. You know, we'd have to do a survey of everybody that watched it.
Yeah.
I suspect there's a huge range of types of people that that watch a show like that. There must be. I just, you know, but I can't really answer that with any kind of factual basis to the answer. I hope it's a broad range, because the more the broader range of reasons that people watch, that means the kind of the broader the spectrum of type of person that's watching it, and there it can, maybe it can impact in a bigger way. You know, if a lot of different types of people watch it.
Do you think that when you think back, I mean, have you changed? I mean, since writing the book and since, you know, helping with the docuseries, how about your personal views? I know you had an interest in it before, but are you more convinced that this stuff is real now than before you embarked upon writing the book?
Oh, definitely, Bob. No question. Because, I mean, really, when I started on that book, you know, I was totally taken by Ian Stevenson's work and Jim Tucker's work on reincarnation. And I knew a little bit about near-death experiences and, you know, a bit here and there. And I totally was open to it. But to have the experiences yourself, you know, nothing comes close to that. So there's no comparison to where I stand before, you know, now as compared to where I did before, which is, of course, to have much more of a understanding of the power of the research and the evidence that exists independently of my own experiences, but also to couple that with the experiences that I had, it gives me a pretty good, you know, hold on all of this. So, yeah, I'm way more open to this reality than I was before, to give you a short answer. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's sort of, in a sense, it kind of diminishes your role as an investigative journalist, because you've you know, the evidence has pushed you to form personal opinions. So
I try to walk the middle road. Yeah, you're right. I mean, I really felt, and it's a good point, because with surviving death, I took a leap in a sense. I mean, you're pointing out the fact that I kind of crossed a line that I'd never crossed before. And I, as you said, with UFOs, it wasn't even an issue because I never saw one. And I always used to think, you know, it's good that I haven't seen one, because I would be asked all the time on interviews, have you seen one? And I was thinking, it's really good that I haven't, because it keeps me really objective. They can't accuse me of being affected by some sighting that I had. I'm totally objective and detached. Now, in this case, it's not true at all. Because, you know, in order to study media, if you want to study mental mediumship, what better way is there to do it? If you want to report on it, be objective about it, what better way is there to do that than to have your own readings, right?
Right.
And readings that are controlled, so you're sure the medium doesn't know anything about you in advance. And so obviously, you know, I just decided to do that. And I scored there. You helped me a lot, you know, provided me help with scoring the readings and finding the mediums and all this stuff. But it turns out I had incredibly impactful readings. And you can't dissociate yourself from the personal effect it has on you, obviously. So I did both. I allowed the readings to have their personal effect so that I could enter into them as any person would, any human being having this experience would, and just be open to it. But then, in, you know, stepping back from it, I'm able to, you know, make lists of what was true and false and maybe and score it and analyze it and think about it and try to learn more about research that's been done on it, like with Julie Beichel's work and other people like that. So I also thought about, you know, leaving all the personal stuff out, especially with the after-death communications. But then I felt that's really not honest. It's not ethical in a sense, because all of that was part of the experiences I had while writing the book. And it impacted me, and I didn't think it was appropriate to pretend it didn't happen. So you're making the point. It sort of felt risky to me to be a journalist being so personal, but I'm also a human being and these things happened, and I had no idea that my brother was going to die when I was writing a book, you know. It happened. Yep. So that became part of the story.
Mm. And I think it added to it. You know, people can relate on a personal level. I think you did a good job in the series balancing the you know, the scientific research with the experiential and the anecdotal evidence, you know, I mean, which is essentially what we try to do in the foundation, you know, and and some people really will tell you that the parts they like the best were the, you know, the science and the research, and others will tell you that they resonated with the, you know, the personal stories. So it is a balance. And I guess you and Ricky were both aware of it when you were putting together the series, right?
Great. And I wish Ricky was here. You're right. I wish Ricky was here to talk more about her perspective, because they, as filmmakers, were more focused on the personal journeys of characters than I, you know, whereas my emphasis was more on research and sort of factual data to back everything up. And so, you know, they're the filmmakers. This really was their series. It wasn't my series. I was there to be a consultant, and I had input into it, of course, and I helped with a lot of the production of some of it. But a lot of it they just did on their own.
Yeah.
And they were, the difference really is that their focus was on the journeys of people. And my book isn't just about the journeys of people. My book has a lot of research in it. It's not dry, but, you know, it has a lot of experts who have studied this for decades, who write a whole chapter. And I'm trying to really sort of show evidence for the reality of survival. And they're not really, their focus in the docuseries was not to show evidence for the reality of survival. It was really to show people telling stories that suggest that, or that touch on that, but it was really more about the people's stories that they were interested. So, you know, if I had produced it, I mean, there were some moments where I felt maybe there could have been a little more research than there was. You know, everybody doesn't see everything the same way. So, but, you know, this was their creative project, and I think it's a great balance to my book because it sort of brings it to life and it makes it very human. And
yeah.
I think they go together really well, but they sort of have a different emphasis.
Yeah. I don't know. Obviously, this is, you know, a question that Ricky would address, but I was just curious when she, you know, first approached Netflix, you know, if she had any inklings of how they would react, you know, because of the subject matter. You know, I mean, I wonder if she was a little hesitant or whether she thought the subject matter would actually be attractive to them more so than being pushed away. You have any?
Yeah. I wish she were on. I've been texting her. I don't know. Something must have come up because she certainly knew about the show tonight. So anyway, yeah. I don't think that there was any sense of sort of being put off by it in any way. You know, I think it was.
Yeah.
I think that what Ricky felt, because sort of with my book as the basis of it, which was so solid and kind of research-based and so not, it wasn't woo-woo, you know, that she always uses as it. She thought, read my book, she didn't think it was woo-woo, she thought it had something really solid about it. And I don't think that the people at Netflix had that kind of reaction at all. I mean, they have all kinds of considerations for why they want to do something or don't want to do something. And they do a lot of weird stuff. I mean, all the time there were movies made about weird things. So, no, I don't think that was an issue, but I wish that she could tell you more about it. This show would be a lot more interesting if she were here. Is that her?
Okay. Well, we'll get her another time.
I thought I had her coming on. Yeah.
Let me ask you about physical mediumship, because, I mean, that was covered in the show. And incidentally, I should mention that you added some content to your website on survivingdeathcane.com, you know, about mediumship and some of the additional research, so people can go to the website and see a lot of the things that didn't or weren't covered, you know, in the series. But
appreciate you mentioning that, Bob. Yeah.
Tell us about your experience with physical mediumship. I mean, you know, that's a lot of stuff. You know, by the way, I always found this kind of strange, but I would say that there's probably the majority of mental mediums today, when you bring up the subject of physical mediumship, a lot of them will tell you that they don't believe it, you know, which is really strange considering that they're doing something like, talking to the deceased. So why would you not, you know, believe somebody else? I mean, after, you know, without examining the evidence. But what was your experience with physical mediumship? How did you get involved?
I'll tell you, but I also wanted to share with you, it's funny you brought that up, because I was just talking with Laura Lynn Jackson about it, and she said she didn't believe it. And I think it's because it's so different from the way mental mediums work. But then we had a long talk about it when I went on a live stream with her and we talked about it, and she's really open to it now. So, yeah, I mean, it's understandable to me that people wouldn't believe it, because it's been poo-pooed throughout history as something that's fraudulent, basically. And that's the way people think of it. And so it's not surprising that people think there's nothing to it. But not only did I study the literature on it, and there is some incredible scientific documentation of certain mediums that were able to produce incredible things under control, so that they were so tightly controlled that fraud was able to be ruled out, and, you know, Nobel Peace Prize-winning scientists were able to document that, in fact, these things occur. And what occurs generally with physical mediums are things, it's what happens is the medium is in a trance state. And so, meaning that he basically kind of vacates his body, I'll just say him, but it can be a her, of course, and it's just sort of gone. And then the spirit communicators will have to actually come into the body of the medium and use the vocal cords of the medium, so they're speaking directly to the people in the room, rather than the way a mental medium would work, which is to communicate to the other side and then bring through the information. This is information that comes direct from the spirit world. And while they're doing this, they can create a lot of physical phenomena in the room. That's why it's called physical mediumship. So you see things like objects levitating around the room. You can hear voices coming from different parts of the room, not directly through the medium, but independent voice is what they call it. You see things like matter going through matter, like a living arm being pulled through a solid strap. I mentioned levitations. And then the biggest thing, the thing that's hardest to fathom, understandably so, is materializations, is the actual materialization of a hand or even of a full form. And this is able to occur because of a substance called ectoplasm that gets exuded from the medium. Now, at this point, everybody listening is probably thinking, what? This is completely bonkers. But I've actually worked with one of the few physical mediums that I'm aware of on the planet today who is genuine, because there is a lot of fraud in physical mediumship. That's absolutely without a doubt. There is. It's very easy, because a lot of it takes place in the dark, because ectoplasm, the substance that the spirits work with, is very sensitive to light. And some of it's in the light. I've witnessed things in the light, but some of it isn't. So it can be easy to stage things for gullible people. But there is at least one genuine physical medium that I've worked with. His name is Stuart Alexander. He's in his mid-70s, been doing this for over 40 years, closer to 50 years. Never been caught with any kind of fraud or anything like that. And I have studied his mediumship and his everything in his room, you know, studied everything that would allow me to eliminate any possibility of fraud. Let's put it that way. I won't go into all the details unless people want to ask me more questions about it. But I've witnessed all these things myself, and so have many others. And the other part of what happens is all this physical stuff, which is just like witnessing miracles that you can't imagine could ever happen. But there's also communications that come through from the other side the same way they do in mental mediumship. So people will hear from their loved ones in the context of one of these sittings. That's always part of it, at least with Stuart. It's not just about demonstrating the physical phenomena. It's also about communicating from the other side. So, and Stuart, you know, I wish he would have been part of our Surviving Death series on Netflix, but he's very media shy. And did not want to participate. He did not want to be exposed to millions and millions of people all over the world. But for those who are interested in learning more about him and physical mediumship, if as you mentioned, on that page that I have on my website, there are some video interviews that Stuart did recently with Jeffrey Mishlove, where he talks about his mediumship. And he rarely does interviews, so I would encourage people to listen to them. And you'll really have a sense of what physical mediumship is about, how he developed without even knowing that it was going to happen to him, and what happens in the seance room, and all the stuff that people have questions about. You can hear it directly from him, and he can talk about it better than I can.
And yeah. in the docuseries, when they were discussing, you know, physical mediumship, it was shown that in the past that there were like paraffin molds of hands that were made. And you actually experienced that with Stewart, right?
I did, and I've also been to see those molds, and I wish that the series had had more coverage about them because they're really spectacular. But yes, not just me, many people over 30 or 40 years have experienced the materialization of a hand. I've never seen it dip into wax like those scientists did that we showed in the film very briefly, but I have seen, and this happens in the light, there's a table in his room. This is in, you know, we call it the seance room. There's a group of maybe anywhere from 5 to 8 or 9 people that will sit in a circle with him. And there's a table that's lit underneath, so the light comes up through the bottom of the table. It has a red cloth over it, so it's not very bright, but it is light. And you can see this cloud of ectoplasm coming over the table. You can see it form into the shape of a hand, and then suddenly it becomes three-dimensional. It's just this one moment where it just kind of lifts up, and you can see that it's a three-dimensional hand, and it bangs on the table so that you hear the sound. And this was something that didn't exist 30 seconds earlier. And then there's also situations where you are allowed to touch the hand. So there's usually the hand will withdraw and then come back and reform, and it'll allow the person sitting close to the table to actually touch it and hold hands with this materialized hand, which I've done many times, and it's just mind-blowing. What can I say?
Yeah, I know.
It's just hard to imagine, but Stewart has a book, and people have contributed pieces to that about describing it. I mean, lots of people have had this experience, and yeah, it's just remarkable, and it feels like a human hand. It's just, if people are curious, I mean, it's large. Quite large, this hand. It doesn't feel anything like Stewart's hand, and Stewart's hands are bound to the chair, and he's got people on either side of him, and he's sitting with a close-knit circle of people that have worked with him decade after decade. There's nobody in that room that's staging this, you know. Yeah. And it's just that, so this hand is very large and very warm and very soft. It felt like, to me, the skin felt like a baby's skin, you know, just soft, but you can feel the knuckles and the fingernails and everything in the hand that's normal, and it moves just like a normal hand would. It kind of shakes your hand and holds it, and then it kind of recedes off the table back into nowhere, wherever it came from. So yeah, it's quite a remarkable thing to witness and to touch.
And of course it's like in anything else. I mean, there's fraud among mental mediums, and there's certainly fraud among, you know, physical mediums. So the point is to getting to the right people. Now, Fran and I once did sit in a seance with a physical medium, and it wasn't, you know, total darkness. And during the session, I was getting for lack of a better term, like hit or swatted by the trumpet that was floating around the room. And not once or twice, but, you know, maybe 15 or 20 times, you know.
You mean unpleasantly, like it was aggressively hitting you, or was it
I felt like I was getting beat up.
Well, that's weird. I've been touched by a trumpet many times, but never with that kind of vibe, always gently.
Yeah, well, my point was that I found it very frustrating afterwards, because there was no way of me making like an independent decision on whether the phenomena were real or not, because it was in darkness. So I couldn't tell if there was trickery going on. So, I mean, I try to keep an open mind, and I look at it from both sides. I mean, it was either an incredible experience or it was fraud, and I can't discern which it was, you know. But,
and it makes total sense, Bob. I mean, the only way you can ever discern is to do what I've done is to get to know the medium, to check out the room, to make sure everything, there's no trickery. You know, it takes time. And if you just go sit once with a medium and it's all in the dark, Your response seems completely rational to me. How would you ever know?
Yeah, that's true.
And you have to investigate it in order to know it, and that's what I've been through. It's been over 5 years that I've been doing that with this one medium. So, and I feel very lucky, because Yeah, otherwise I would have all the same questions you do. It's completely, I sat with, you know, medium, well, there was a German medium I sat with, and there are some questions that came up in his mediumship, and you just don't know most of the time.
Yeah.
You don't know how to interpret it.
Now, you mentioned before you even, you know, wrote the book that you found, you were very curious about, you know, past life memories, and you did a good job, you know, in the series with, you know, with Jim Tucker talking about some of the more prominent cases of past life memories. I have to tell you, the case of Marty Martin, where the child remembered a past life as an actor, it's an extraordinary case. But at the end of the story, I don't know if it was just me, but I felt somewhat saddened when the child, now an adult, you know, was brought back with Jim, you know, to the previous family. But, you know, at that point, he couldn't remember the family, and the family didn't really see anything in them. So I thought that, it was somewhat sad in that situation. So I was wondering, was there a decision whether to put that in the film, you know, or was it really to point out the fact that past life memories of children tend to fade once they reach, you know, age 5 or 6, or, you know, was there any thought process that went into that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad you brought that up, because it was, the way I would describe that scene is one word: awkward. Would you agree?
Yeah.
Awkward and sort of
awkward.
Weird and uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
<right.
laughs> And, you know, right. I was there. I was very much involved with the whole shoot with Ryan and his family. And you're right. I mean, I think, you know, the filmmaker's intention really is just to show, again, what it was like for these people. My intention, of course, was that that point be made that you just brought up, because these members of his previous family, and that alone is weird enough, that he's this 15-year-old who remembered being somebody who had a daughter who was 8 years old when he died, right, in his previous life. And now he's seeing this, his previous daughter, as a woman in her 60s. So that alone is weird. But the other problem was that this woman and another family member of Marty Martin's had the idea that Ryan should remember all these things now that he didn't even remember when he was 5. And so it was an awkward situation. So they would ask him, well, you were in Paris as Marty Martin when Charles Lindbergh landed, you know, and then they think, how could he not remember that? And the point is, and, you know, I feel like that point needs to be very clearly made, that, as you said, Bob, that these kids almost always forget all these memories by the time they're 6 or 7. And they cannot be expected as teenagers or adults to suddenly remember things because somebody asks them a question. It just doesn't work that way. And yeah, I hope, so. You know, I'm not sure that point, to be honest, came across clearly enough in the documentary. It was a very important concern of mine that it come through. And I, for some reason, Ricky is now calling my phone. So what I would suggest, Bob, is that your producer call Ricky right now.
Okay.
I'm not going to pick it up because anyway, I don't know if you just want me to keep talking. Yeah.
I'll mention the producer will call.
Yeah, well, have the producer call her. But the point being that, so that situation was a bit strange because those two family members didn't understand that that's not how it works with these children. And even when Ryan was 5 years old, he had 55 verified memories. But they didn't all have, he didn't remember everything that they thought maybe he should have remembered. You know, who's to say what a child's going to remember and what he's not going to remember?
Okay.
So these two family members, they were not really educated about how the whole thing works, and that made it even more strange. But it was interesting to see
Wesley,
them all
interact. we have Ricky with us.
I'm so glad.
Okay.
I'm so sorry. I thought we were doing this at 9. Okay. Well,
okay.
There you go. That
all
goes
right.
To
well,
show you.
We. I'm glad you're here. Let me give you a quick introduction. Ricky Stern is the creative force of Breakthrough Films. She's a film director, screenwriter, producer, author, mostly known for her documentarian work. She's prolific. Some of her projects are featured in both the film and television, and some of her best-known work includes The Trials of Daryl Hunt, The Devil Came on Horseback, The End of America, Joan Rivers, A Piece of Work, The Preppy Murder, Death in Central Park, Surviving Jeffrey Epstein, and now Surviving Death. And I should add, Ricky's also the author of a children's book series, Beryl Bean, Mighty Adventurer of the Planet. You can learn more about Ricky and Breakthrough Films on breakthroughfilms.org, and through is THRU. So welcome, Ricky.
Hello. Oh, again, I'm so sorry. For some reason, I had this at 9 o'clock. So thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. So, I asked Leslie this question. So, let me ask you from the point of view as the filmmaker. I'm curious as how you decide what your next project is going to be. I mean, is it usually a story that you just happen upon and it just resonates with you, and you think it would make a good, a good project? Or how do these projects come to you?
It's definitely a mix. So I would say early in my career, I worked at HBO in-house, but I was always, passionate about doing my own work. And it's kind of like if you're an artist or you're someone or a writer, you can't help but do the thing you love. And so for me, it was telling stories through film. And so even while I was working, full time at HBO, I just had this itch that I had to tell stories. So, in that case, I found a story about a boxing gym in the Bronx and young boxers, and I wanted to tell their story. And sometimes now it comes as, someone will come to us, my filmmaking partner, Annie Sundberg, and I, who did most of the films that you were talking about. Will come and say, we have this project. Are you interested? In the case of Surviving Death, I knew Leslie and I had worked before on her previous book, and I knew her personally. We have mutual friends, and read her book and had been just launching a film for Netflix that we did for Netflix called Reversing Roe, and happened to talk to some executives at Netflix and said, my friend did this book. Is this of interest? And they were really interested. Everybody who I've spoken to about sort of this topic is fascinated by it.
That's, that's interesting, because I was going to ask you about that, because most of your prior projects involved, an examination of a historical figure or somebody in the news or personality or an event. And this was a departure, and you knew that it was going to be some of the material was going to be controversial, and that opinions were going to be diverse. But that's what makes a good documentary, I would imagine. You want to open minds, and you want people to talk about it. And so I was curious. I mentioned to Leslie what Netflix reaction was when you first approached them, but from what you just said, they were very interested from the start.
Well, I would also say, though, that the sort of theme through all my work is character, is, I did a film about Darfur, about the genocide there, but it was really about getting deep with a young former U.S. Marine captain who had been in Darfur. It's about the people whose lives are invested in whatever the story is. And I think that's the same thing with Surviving Death, which is we don't necessarily do the deep analysis that Leslie does in her book, but we go deep with individual characters and people who have had experiences that have been profound. And that to me is interesting. And that's probably across all my work. And I think Netflix feels the same. What they liked about the project when I brought it to them was that it was Leslie's particular focus on it, which was serious and clinical and scientific with research, because they didn't want to do something that was just sort of like a, I don't want to like critique Ghostbusters, but kind of thing, or like a, ghost hunting kind of thing. But they just wanted something that was going to be a serious look at something that a lot of people are thinking about or questioning or wondering about, which is this notion of, what happens after we die.
Right. And it was, It was balanced, as we were just talking, you know, before, in the respect that you mixed in the scientific research with the experiential and the anecdotal, you know, evidence and personal stories. So you hit it from both perspectives, and it worked because it was balanced, and you didn't go, you know, overboard, you know, with one or the other. There was something for everybody, you know. The thing that I'm curious about, and I think a lot of people are interested in the behind-the-scenes stuff, I don't know. I mean, I know how much filming that you did, you know, across the world for this and how long it took. I have no idea how you even begin the editing process. I mean, how does that work? Do you sit down with a team as you pour over all the video and audio and everybody makes suggestions on what to keep and what not to keep? Or it's daunting.
Yeah, no, we don't do that because that would be a nightmare. But yeah. We, you know, I because Leslie's book was really like a backbone for the series, we were ahead of the game in that regard.
Yeah.
You know, she had done the hard work of speaking to a lot of the, you know, the people who had been doing this research, so we knew who we were potentially going to go after. And there were definitely stories that are not in her book that we found, but with the guidelines that Leslie had set up in her research. And then, so it's pretty well organized before it gets the editor. So what we filmed, while to your point, like, you know, we spent a lot of time at the grief retreat, which was amazing, and there were so many stories and so many people who, you know, it could have been its own piece. You know, you make those hard choices, as we say in the doc world, you kill your babies, you know. You have, sorry to say that, sounds like awful in this context, but, yeah. You know, there are these wonderful people or stories that you just can't use because their story doesn't advance the plot, or their story seems repetitive with someone else's story. And that's always really hard. And, you know, that process, that's why I get a really good editor who can be more objective than I can be, because I fall in love with all my people. I fall in love with all the scenes, and I don't want to cut anything.
Right. Yeah. I could understand that. Let somebody else be the bad guy.
Exactly. Exactly.
You know, one thing that I did appreciate that you put in on the subject of mediumship is that we do live in an age that's a lot different than when mediumship was practiced, you know, 50 or 100 years ago, and that, you know, we live in this age of unlimited information, and half of everybody's life can be uncovered by a few clicks on the web. So, I mean, you did point mm-hmm. that out, that certainly, you know, qualified mediums don't resort to such tactics, but realistically, though, there are a lot that do. You know, they just look people up and they do readings that are fraudulent. It's a real problem today. Something that you wouldn't even think of, you know, back in the day. And you did raise that question in the series, which I think was legitimate, and appreciate you doing that. You know, we had once in our medium certification process, on a questionnaire that we sent out, you know, early in the process, we asked the medium what information that she gathered from the sitter before a reading, and her answer was, "I Google every one of my sitters to become familiar with them." I thought it was a joke. I mean. I mean, that she,
right.
She has an award for stupidity for admitting that, you know, but it is a problem, you know.
But I appreciate that because, you know, we really struggled with trying to illustrate how you and Fran with the Forever Family Foundation have come up with ways in which you can test and, you know, and certify medium so that the vulnerable people who are grieving are not, or, you know, can look to you. I mean, what you provide is, you know, another layer, another level of protection of some sort, of like due diligence.
But it was a hard thing to sort of illustrate, and we had a wonderful medium from your group come, and we tried to do it, and it just got so in the weeds, and it was way, as you know, many steps to do the certification that we never ended up illustrating it in the series. But I wish we had, because I think a lot of people, you know, that's very important information, and that's obviously what Leslie, too, will talk about that, you know, that you really don't want to give anybody your email, your name, you know, well, your last name. You just don't want to give them any opportunity to Google you or to find out information about you in advance of your reading.
Right. So, I mean, obviously, Leslie was very well versed in this, you know, having, wrote the book. I don't know how much you knew about the various subjects, you know, before getting involved with Leslie and her book. But now that the project is complete, do you have any personal opinion about what offers the strongest evidence for life after death? Was this something that really got you, you know, that this can't be a product of one's imagination? I mean, would it be, you know, past life memories? It would have been near death experiences, or
I will say just broadly and generally, you know, people have asked me, like, so have you know, I went into this not being someone who had ever been to a medium, not someone who ever read a book about any of this, reincarnation, near-death experiences, really was not, under my radar, not something I was particularly interested in, but found, you know, through Leslie's book, it's pretty fascinating, and loved talking to the researchers and then the people who've experienced these incredible, you know, phenomenons. But I do think, you know, it is sort of the evidence based stories like reincarnation that you really do wonder, well, how could this young person, Ryan Hammond, know all these things? You hear my voice in the documentary with Marty Martin's daughter saying, like, that's a lot of things that this kid knew. And you know, she says, yeah, it was. You know, sometimes you can't hold back, you know. So I think that which is episode 6 is, and I think Leslie will say this, episode 1, which is near death experience, and episode 6 are probably, you know, some of the strongest, if you're looking for evidence or, you know, cases that have been explored and analyzed, because they are cases that have been, under the work of the doctors at the Department of the Division of Perceptual Studies at the University of Virginia in the medical school. But there's so many other wonderful sort of experiences, like the Deborah Blum, who's the MIT professor, who talks about her work looking at ghosts, but also her own family's connection to it, where her father-in-law talks about, you know, when he woke up in the middle of the night and thought of his, I'm going to forget if it was his cousin, but who he felt had, you know, had died, and then went back to bed, or was calling him, went back to bed, woke up in the morning and found out that his, I forget, I'm sorry if I don't remember if it was his cousin, who killed himself at the, do you remember who it was, Leslie?
It was his cousin. I remember it was his cousin.
Yeah, he had killed himself at exactly the time that he had woken up from a deep sleep. He had this experience that his cousin was there calling to him. And those kinds of stories, there are so many of those stories, those anecdotes that we all, you know, you just have to sort of ask your neighbor, has this ever happened to you? That I find, like, startling.
I think that the value that you provided is having such a broad spectrum, because people will sit back, you know, after watching all, you know, 6, you know, episodes, and they may have watched, you know, 1 or 2 that they might dismiss. But when they step back at the end and they reflect upon everything that they've seen, then a belief that we're more than our physical bodies becomes logical, because you can't dismiss everything. It makes no sense to, you know, you can dismiss one thing. And I think that it was very important to the science. It's something that we always believed in, because you have to add credibility to this stuff. I mean, all the personal accounts are nice, but I think it's the people like myself. I mean, I needed the science end of it to open me up into to the personal experiences. I couldn't accept any personal experiences without, you know, realizing that there are credible people, like people at DOPS, and, you know, that study these things and have studied them for 100 years or more. And so it's not woo-woo, and you've done a good job in doing that. So I applaud both of you for that. There were what goes next? I mean, either if you plan on doing any further exploration in this area, or you're going to move on to other things.
Leslie,
well, I mean, I'm continuing to explore it, Bob. That's my simple answer. I will always be, and I'm working with the Bigelow Center for Consciousness Studies in, and we've got a whole thing going there, and that's. We don't have time to talk about that, but I will continue on this journey probably forever. But Ricky, I'm sure, has a different relationship to all of this.
Yeah, well, that's it. That's the nature of her work.
You know? But I want her to be able to speak on it. I don't want to. Yeah. I've spoken a lot about
it. No, I mean, yeah. I think it's fascinating, and you know, I guess, you know, I'm thinking about this for the first time. I guess I would love to pursue this, but I would love to pursue this in a way to, you know, further make films about it or document it. You know, on my personal exploration, oh, I don't know. I mean, I read a million different books. I have like 6 books that I'm like go between, and I love to read a ton of different things. So I don't know if it's probably not my personal obsession, but I would love to be able to explore it further in documentary, because I find it so fascinating to hear the stories and to read the literature and to be able to then translate it for a broader audience.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, listen, the nature of what you do, I mean, you could wake up tomorrow and get really excited about something totally different, and you're off to the races. So I understand that. I mean, you go where you're guided. I think that then I had asked Leslie before, and what's been the reaction so far? What kind of feedback are you getting?
You know, it's interesting. We've gotten incredible. We have really many, many people have seen the series, and Leslie probably gets more direct contact. But what I think is so interesting is how international it is. How, you know, apparently it's doing really well in Brazil, and this morning I did a podcast in Israel, and I think that's what's so fascinating about it. And also, like, there is a strong sense of, like, and you can see this on Leslie's Facebook page, of, like, appreciation. Thank you, thank you, thank you for doing this. So, because I think people want some validation for either their own experiences or you know, some serious look at this, which has, you know, normally been considered, as you said, woo-woo. And then, of course, this is a topic that engenders very strong feelings on both sides. And I think, you know, we certainly have had people who are incredibly offended by the notion of looking at survival. And I don't know if that's because of their own religious or cultural beliefs or histories, but or they call it pseudoscience or whatever they, you know, feel is a way to reject it. But people,
welcome to our world.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, that's
reaction to it on both sides, I would say.
Yeah, absolutely. And I will tell you that I know that membership in our foundation has gone up significantly, and a lot more international members. To your point, so it is something that's watched throughout the globe. So unfortunately, our time is up. I want to encourage everybody, learn more about Ricky and Breakthrough Films, and that's Break, B-R-E-A-K, through, T-H-R-U, films.org. And, of course, Leslie's website, which has that new added feature about information that didn't make it into the to the series, and that's SurvivingDeathKane, K-E-A-N.com. Ricky and Leslie, thank you so much for being with us tonight. We appreciate you and hope to talk to you again soon.
Thanks so much,
Bob. All right, take care.
I sure appreciate you also.
Yeah,
thank you.
We do.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. And now we would like to say, let us as one consciousness give our energy of loving thought by praying like this: to love one another, to treat others as we would like to be treated, and to forgive others and return love for hate, kindness for anger, to spread this feeling to everyone, to our fellow man, as well as the earth and its environment. And thank you all for joining us, and we'll talk to you next week. Take care. Good night.